Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I am your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today on episode 236, I have the pleasure of being joined by three of my colleagues to discuss the general implications of telemedicine in the COVID-19 and post-COVID-19 era on how medical care is delivered in the United States and other countries. I'm joined by Drs. Farina Ali, Ehsan Rahimi, and Sarah Reed, and we review several issues, including what we've already seen in terms of telemedicine adoption, what we can expect to see in the near future, and kind of the pitfalls and downsides that need to be addressed as we continue to adapt and use telemedicine for delivering medical care. As always, you can claim CME for this podcast episode and other episodes by clicking on the link in the episode description, and a list of financial disclosures that are relevant is in the episode description as well. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be joined by three retina specialists from three different time zones in alphabetical order. First, we have Dr. Farina Ali joining us from Dallas, Texas. Farina, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Jay.
Next, Dr. Ehsan Rahimi from Palo Alto in San Francisco, California, part of the Palo Alto Medical Foundation. Ehsan, welcome, first time.
Hey, Jay, thanks for having me.
And last but not least, Dr. Sarah Reed, who is just trying to squeeze as many podcasts as she can out of the coronavirus pandemic, even if it means waking up at 5:30 a.m. to record.
Hi, Jay. Thanks for having me.
You know, I'm not going to throw you under the bus, but I do realize that each time we've come on, your start time has gotten earlier. I think we were at like 8 a.m., and then it was like 7 a.m., and then it was like 6 a.m. Now it's 5:30, and now I just feel bad, and we're going to be recording at 2 a.m. at some point. I'm going to have to cut you off like a bartender at 2 a.m.
That's fair.
We're here to talk about telemedicine. We talked a little bit about telehealth in the context of how retina providers are using it in retina practices, and telehealth has some applications, I think, in retinal disease, but there are some huge implications for not just medicine, but just industry and how Americans and the rest of the world view health and maybe preventative health in terms of telemedicine that maybe will be a silver lining of this whole pandemic. If there is a silver lining to COVID-19, maybe this is one of them. And I sent you guys, Ehsan came up with this idea. He talked a lot about telehealth, and you all have varying backgrounds in telehealth. There are a couple of articles that came out in the lay media a couple of weeks ago and discussing it. One of them was talking about how Americans have doubled their attempts to use telemedicine during COVID-19, which is not a surprise. And the other was kind of an article outlining reasons why telemedicine may be here to stay, and things that they referenced included, you know, the fact that it needed to be adopted. There was a necessity for it to be adopted. And so people now have tried it. And so they've had an opportunity to try it, because one of the biggest barriers is getting patients and providers to try it. The second is kind of the reduced regulation by the government and more reimbursement. That's also been a kind of a ripple effect of COVID-19. The other reasons, including that the technology will continue to evolve, right? When the capturing of video information, exam information, and also just maybe the ability to pool kind of information from different telehealth encounters and really reach patients who maybe didn't have access to care, maybe enhanced. So I'm going to let Ehsan, since this was your idea, I'm going to let you kick this off. In terms of telemedicine, I think it's something that we've all talked about for screening. People talked about underdeveloped countries, but this has really kind of jump-started it in terms of in developed countries, how it's going to be utilized. What are kind of the biggest unmet needs you think it's going to meet? And why do you think it is kind of here to stay, that this is kind of a permanent shift in the way we conduct medicine?
Definitely. It's a great kind of launching question into this. And I think telemedicine, it's been growing. You know, it's been kind of a grassroots movement, I think, especially in our field in ophthalmology, a lot of imaging-based specialties for the better part of the last year. But coronavirus, I just think, really accelerated this timeline and kicked it into high gear for a lot of us. We're out here in the Bay Area, so we were kind of an epicenter, if you will, of when the virus started to pick up infection rates in the community. And then we reacted pretty early on due to the mayor of San Francisco, you know, declaring emergency, and the governor of California. So we were forced from a practice perspective to start thinking creatively. And, you know, it's unfortunate that a crisis like coronavirus has happened, but sometimes it's through a crisis that some opportunities arise to improve care and do the best things for our patients. So I think the biggest area of unmet need is actually to maintain the care of our established patients who don't necessarily need to be coming into the clinic. And I think one of the lowest hanging fruits really are a lot of these routine follow-ups. If you think about dry AMD, diabetic retinopathy follow-ups, plaquenil screenings. So things that, depending on your practice environment, maybe the retina specialist is seeing, but also maybe the regular ophthalmologists are seeing as well too. And we've created with some other colleagues, Steve Houston, John Miller, you guys know them, this kind of hybridized tele-eye care approach where the idea of a patient comes in really on their own time, get some diagnostic imaging, can be OCT, fundus photo, you know, visual field if it's a plaquenil screen. They go home, then they can schedule a televisit follow-up, whether it's by phone or video conference if they have that capability to go over the results. And depending on the platform that you use in our system, we have access to WebEx. Although, again, the nice thing is with the regulations being kind of eased up a little bit, you can use Zoom, you can use FaceTime, et cetera. But I like platforms like WebEx and Zoom because they allow you to screen share and you can share a patient's image with them. You can share an educational PowerPoint about diabetes, AMD, et cetera. And I found that patients have been just extremely receptive to this. They get a lot of one-on-one education and they actually feel like you're spending a lot more time with them than if it was in the middle of a busy 80-patient clinic. So to that end, I think this has staying power. I'm curious if the others on the call, what their experience has been thus far.
You know, Sarah, you talked last time we talked about this, about how you're utilizing it in your practice. And obviously there's definitely going to be cultural differences in how patients approach medicine and providers, both within certain areas. For example, diversity like Miami, you'll get kind of, or LA or a lot of places, you get different sort of cultural reactions from patients to medicine, depending on their background. But you're on an island in Hawaii, was going to have differences than other parts of the country. You've utilized it quite a bit in your practice. Do you see yourself scaling back? So you did this out of necessity for the pandemic, but in 6 months or a year, let's say, you know, knock on wood, 18 months, we have a vaccine. This isn't as big a, the public health crisis is over. Do you think A, you would want to utilize it, and B, are your patients going to be amenable, or are they going to want to switch back? Like, are they happier this way?
So I think, great question. And that's such a, I'm so interested in what's going on in Palo Alto. That sounds like you guys have a really great system set up. I think when it comes to what's going on with the pandemic, we're sort of seeing this almost emerge as like a disruptive technology where it's changing the way patients are viewing their healthcare and the way we're viewing a patient interaction and what we define as a patient interaction and patient care. I have found, similar to one of the articles that you mentioned and similar to what else has been described, that the response from patients is really positive, even given the limitations of how I'm doing telemedicine, which doesn't include having the patient come in for fundus photos and all these other things. Really, it's just a vision and an Amsler screen. But, you know, in this particular setting where we're really trying to prevent the patient from coming in, that can be sufficient at least to risk stratify patients, triage patients, and see who needs to come in and who we can delay having come in for an in-person visit. I think going forward, there are a significant number of patients who really like this approach, and I think that's going to convince physicians that this is a viable way to approach patient care. You know, not only did the regulatory barriers change, but the financial reimbursements changed too, and I think that not only made this a viable way to set it up easily within the practice, but also to have this be a way to actually see patients and generate income from patient encounters, which was not true before for the majority of patient visits. So I think it sort of depends on whether or not those financial reimbursements and regulatory barriers sort of are changed. But I think the response from patients has been good enough that that may put pressure on having these legislative changes stay in place, even after some of the dangers from the virus go down.
And Farina, we're going to come back to that money point, because there's a huge other conversation about finances and the long-term implications of this we can talk about that I want to get back to. Farina, in terms of, let's talk just purely from a medical perspective. We've already talked about the limitations maybe in retina, but from a medical perspective, in general medicine, do you think, I mean, if people are able to access healthcare from their mobile device, for example, do you think that this is going to improve A, people's adherence to certain screenings, B, medication adherence? For example, as a patient who takes blood pressure medication, do we think we're going to see increased adherence over time? Maybe we'll get this data in 6 months to a year. Do you think it's going to decrease? I mean, your gut instinct, do you think the in-person component plays any role, or is it greater access that will play a greater role in people actually doing preventative care, meaning taking their blood pressure, doing their routine labs, exercising, weight loss, that sort of thing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are really great questions. So I think a couple of things. In terms of prior data that we have around, you know, different apps or different text messaging services and different things like that for chronic care patients, both in internal medicine, but also for our glaucoma patients in terms of their eye drops and all that, I don't think that we've necessarily seen a robust sort of delta in the compliance with care for those patients that are interacted with in a different way through multiple modalities as compared to the status quo. I mean, I think now we are at a really interesting time where, like, echoing the sentiment that this sort of time of need allows for a very interesting, creative sort of pivot in our field and how we manage care. So I think for retina, it could be something kind of very unique. In terms of, you know, sort of the uptake, I think that, you know, even just amongst, you know, the four of us, we're in such different parts of the country with different, sometimes different healthcare models, but many different sort of political climates, you know, socioeconomic sort of concerns, geography, Hawaii being kind of an example of that as well, that I think can make it so that it's going to be a very heterogeneous uptake. But sort of thinking in those parameters makes a lot of sense. I myself have been a patient through telehealth sort of since this COVID time. I unfortunately got COVID, and that's a separate story, but my medical and my general internal medicine visits as related to that were through telehealth. And obviously, you know, there are limitations there in terms of evaluation and things like that. But the upside, of course, being that I'm at home, not getting anybody else, you know, sick or passing along the disease and able to get some sort of insight from my doctor, results, things like that. And then I've also resumed care with my dermatologist during this time. And I have to say, I much prefer telehealth visits. I don't have to, like, kind of try to get to the appointment amidst my clinic day to kind of, you know, get a quick 5-minute check. And so I would love to continue that forward. I don't want to go back to the office. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think those are real positives. But that being said, I am part of a generation where, you know, I'm plugged into my phone all the time and I have an iPad and this and that. And I think for our patient population, I think those hurdles can be more significant, but I think necessity can make it surmountable, probably, is my take.
So let's talk about some of, we're going to get into challenges. I like to play devil's advocate and kind of talk about the things that may not be so great about this or things that will have to be kind of strategized for the future. But let's kind of come back full circle on this whole discussion about preventative care. Farina, I think you're absolutely right. I think that one of the biggest complaints patients have, for example, why do they go to emergency rooms, is they can't get access to care quickly enough. But on the other hand, I think one thing that we may see as well is how we kind of educate people in school, right? It's not like, I'm curious, like, if you think from let's even go further back than residency, let's go to medical school. Do you think one of the complaints, for example, that's been about the millennial generation of medical students has been they don't know how to interact with patients the same way, that they, you know, they generationally, they just aren't on the same wavelength. They use technology, and even though the patients are over time going to use more of that, they don't interact with their older patients to do that. The older patients have now sometimes been forced by the circumstances to either use it or have a family member help them use it. Do you think that we're going to change how we teach this in medical school? Do you think telemedicine will be part of medical school education?
That's a great question. And I think it is. And I think it's already happening in some regards when we think about how I'm not intimately tied to a training program, at least in our practice. We're kind of in more of a hybrid approach, but I'm hearing of situations where residencies, fellowships are already starting to use telemedicine. They're being forced into the situation. And you'd have to think if they're staying power to this, and if it's going to become integrated into our practices, that's going to become part of a curriculum. I don't think all of our care is going to be shifted over to telemedicine. You know, a lot of it's, I think, subspecialty dependent. Ophthalmology lends itself to be very telemedicine friendly, I think, for certain conditions. When you talk about telemedicine, they say there's three branches to it. We have store and forward, which you think about, I think the traditional is the simplest way we thought about, especially with diabetic screening. Somebody comes in, gets a picture, the image gets stored and interpreted remotely. Then you have the direct virtual consultation or the direct teleservice that we think about, services like Teladoc and MD Live and whatnot. And the third component is remote monitoring. And if you guys think about it, you know, retina is on the cusp of this. So not just retina ophthalmology. We talk about the home IOP monitoring that's going on right now. The nodal vision, like home OCT, 4C home, some of these apps that can monitor your vision. So if you think about it, we're really, there's this perfect storm brewing where, especially in our field, all three components come together. To get to your point, Jay, about this lack of interaction with patients, or, you know, really getting to know your patient, this criticism of this younger generation, I'll echo what I said earlier. In the right type of patient that we've been using this for, this approach, these routine patients coming in for follow-ups, they've actually been extremely happy, more happy than if they came into the clinic. Mm-hmm. And they come into our types of clinics, especially retina, super busy, super high volume. They feel like they're, you know, they're just in a factory machine. They're coming in, being seen, and like they don't even have a minute or two of your time, and they know you're already in a rush to go do an injection. Whereas I can't tell you how many patients I've had, like, I'm on a televisit call with them. They feel like they have all the time in the world with you. You're not there in person, but just seeing your face, and even if it's a telephone visit, not feeling like they're rushed, it means a lot to them. They actually feel like they make more of a bond. So I think one of the bigger criticisms before COVID happened, when we were talking about a diabetic screening projects, because those tended to be more of just the soar and forward approach, right? Think about having a camera somewhere, a patient comes in, gets an image, remote, you know, greater UME, whoever reads it and interprets it, then sends a report. The criticism always been, how are you going to enforce that patient actually comes back for a visit? And I think that's where, when you do this hybrid approach, where you combine these different modalities together. So when you do that soar and forward, but follow up with a phone call, or the video visit where you get that personalized touch, my compliance rate with follow-up has been 100%. And I've been very surprised that when you add that personalized touch to it, when you actually directly communicate with the patient, instead of like a, you know, a printed up report saying, hey, go get your eyes checked, when you actually talk to them, when you do a little bit of education, which you have the capability to with some of these platforms, then that actually like really ties it together. And I think you start to see like behavioral change, and you can increase compliance with follow-up visits, with routine visits, and to get them to come in for treatment if needed.
So
I agree.
Go ahead, Sarah.
I was just going to say, I agree completely that I found that even when I do phone calls with patients, the response usually is one where they feel like I'm more invested in their care, where I am reaching out more, and they feel like they're being very well taken care of. And I agree that also in turn strengthens that bond between the physician and the patient. Especially right now with the virus, I think there's a lot of fear going on. And so having that reassurance helps as well, but I can definitely see that being something that even outside of COVID would strengthen a physician patient interaction, by doing sort of a video conference, with them in their home, in where they're comfortable. So I think that's a really great point.
So now I'm going to play devil's advocate. I think this is the most important thing to talk about, is what are the ripple effects? Because I think we've all done, you guys did an amazing job kind of summarizing the benefits and kind of where we see this going forward. But what are going to be the ripple effects or possible negative effects, and how do we combat those, right? So the first thing, and Sarah, you just talked about those positive feelings, and you talked about that personal touch, how people have responded positively. How much, Farina, do you think, and this is true of maybe everything related, there's such a positive feeling as a country and as a world and a society towards health providers and medical providers right now, appropriately so, given the pandemic and the role they serve in. But I would equate it to any crisis, for example, during a war, the positive feelings towards soldiers in the military, during a terrorist attack like September 11th, the positive feelings there were created towards first responders, firefighters, and policemen in New York. Is this going to wear off? And if it does wear off, are patients, is the gratitude going to decrease as a society? Is that going to change these sort of encounters and what people are happy with, right?
Sure. That is such an interesting question because I think it gets at a lot of things. So the parallel that you described with, you know, soldiers or the kind of first responders for 9/11, we know that that garners like such positive sentiment, such patriotism, and like sort of a renewed energy. But then we also know that downstream, those folks suffer from PTSD, there's mental health issues that arise, their ability to do their job in the way that they used to is likely diminished. And I think the likelihood that we're going to see that with our own providers is very high. So I think that that is something that deserves attention now. But in terms of, you know, kind of the latter point of, you know, can we sustain this long term or will the gratitude exist? I mean, I think it sort of reminds me a little bit of, you know, our parents' generations or generations prior to that where like physicians are held in such high regard and like really, I think that cultural shift has changed a lot too. So I kind of see that as a parallel too. Do these sort of sentiments wane over time? Probably yes. And so I think that it being systematized around, you know, the insurers, the payers, Medicare, like that sort of thing, the more it's linked with that, by necessity, people are going to have to plug in a way that's prescribed to them. I think the choice will probably be limited, and that will, in my guess, ensure kind of a sustained utilization of some sort.
And so this goes into my second point, which is expectations, Asan. So, and this may be appropriate. One of the biggest complaints, not just in medicine, but throughout the world, is we have greater accessibility to people and people expect to be available. This isn't the days where you leave a message on Friday and you get a call back on Monday. There's an expectation throughout business, industry, and in medicine now that if you reach out, that you're going to get a response, texting, an email, some sort of more instant response. And the boundaries between having a quote-unquote personal life and having a work life are getting blurred. And again, I think we've all done this, not just medical providers, but everyone's kind of done this because of technology. Do you think that the expectations for availability and kind of what sort of things can be achieved, and the second part of expectations is what sort of things can be achieved in a telehealth visit versus coming in, right? Farina referenced, she doesn't want to go in. I don't want to go in. I mean, most of us would agree, we're busy. We don't want to go in. There's going to be times where people have to come in. Right now, people may be more willing because of the positive feelings to trust their medical providers. But there's kind of legal implications if you have somebody in a telehealth encounter, you're trying to recommend them to come in for something. You've assessed something from a telehealth standpoint, but they won't follow up on it. What about sort of the expectations from the patient side and then what it means legally for providers in terms of covering themselves if they're not exposed, for example, for doing a test and then not being able to get a patient to follow up on that test result?
First, about the availability aspect, I totally agree with that. And I think especially during coronavirus, I think I speak for most of us, there were many days where we couldn't go in the clinic or we've condensed down our clinics, and other days when we were home doing administrative tasks. And so we filled in some of these gaps with the televisit type of appointment. As we've started to ramp back up our clinics and move back into seeing these patients again, the way it's sort of been envisioned or integrated into the practice is to sort of build in these visits into, you know, white space that is available on the clinic schedule. So the idea being that, you know, you wouldn't be doing these at night when you're at home with your family per se. These are visits that are being incorporated into your regular day while you don't have as busy or as full of a clinic schedule anymore. So you're kind of decompressing your clinical volume. You're adding in these televisits as you go. These could be video visits. And if you think about it, depending on your practice situation, you sometimes have multiple offices, right? You could have, at least in the Bay Area here, I go to only two offices, but we have ophthalmologists or optometrists in up to like 5, 6, 7 different offices. So you can have patients come into one of those ancillary sites, get their imaging, and then I can do a televisit with them rather than having them drive all the way over to see me. So I think that's kind of the way we're moving forward in terms of availability. It'll still be during routine office hour type of availability. It's just you, instead of seeing 60 patients in a day, maybe you're seeing 30 patients in a day and 15 to 20 kind of telehealth type visits.
Hmm.
And so here's the second part. Sarah, we were talking a little bit earlier about finances and how things are being reimbursed. And if they aren't, then, you know, things may change. But let's say they are reimbursed. But one of the things that happens with medical reimbursement is the faster you can do something and the more efficiently you can do something, the less it gets reimbursed over time. And maybe that's appropriate and maybe it's not. I guess it depends on the scenario. But we've seen that in ophthalmology with cataract surgery, for example, where cataract surgery used to be reimbursed a certain amount when it was a certain length, the procedure with a certain recovery. And as it became more efficient and faster, the reimbursement went down. Do you think, again, there's greater efficiency with these visits? And unfortunately, anytime you have a code, there's going to be a very small subpopulation of physicians who will unfortunately maybe overuse a code or overtax a code. Do you think over time that the money will sort of dry up and then all of a sudden doctors will be kind of stuck doing telemedicine and then not necessarily having it be financially as viable? There are plenty of examples of medicine. Things are good. Like, for example, vaccines for pediatric patients aren't necessarily, quote unquote, a moneymaker for pediatricians. They do it as a public service and they do it because it's a necessity. Do you think that telemedicine could kind of, right now, they've incentivized it to promote it, but over time, if it's overutilized and or the money kind of dries up, because again, if it's such an efficient thing, why should we reimburse you to, you know, do a 10-minute phone call, that it doesn't become as viable for providers, especially in a private practice setting?
Absolutely. I think that that's definitely a concern with telemedicine. I wouldn't necessarily say it's more efficient for the physician, because right now, the way telemedicine works, it's a 15-minute interaction, which is more than I will often spend with a routine follow-up patient in the clinic. It's a time saver when you think about it from the patient's point of view. So it's very efficient on the side of the patient, maybe less so on the side of the physician. And it'll have to remain to be seen whether or not they allow a shorter interaction time to have bill at the same level. But I would say for right now, yes, and it still doesn't bill as much as having the patient come in, and you're not doing imaging, which for retina is another major revenue source. So if you're just doing telemedicine, as things open back up, I don't think that's actually going to replace the normal patient visits. But I agree, the areas where it really comes in handy, and I think is something that I will continue to do as long as I'm able to, is we also see patients on neighbor islands. So Kauai and Maui, we have patients, not clinics, but patients who come in from Hilo. And with the restrictions on flying, patients really aren't able to do that as much. And so one of the ways I'll use telemedicine is to help to triage those patients who've seen a provider on their own island, and they can send me photographs or images, and then I can do a telehealth conference with the patient, decide if they need to fly over or if we can see them, you know, next time we're actually going to the outer island. And that's where I think this sort of really shines, is in helping to triage patients where the access to care is especially challenging, similar to not having them drive in or having to drive a few hours to come see you. And so I think that's where it's going to make a big difference. As far as the reimbursement, I just don't think that this is going to take over a huge proportion of my patients. I think it'll be sort of a few patients who are having trouble traveling. Here, nursing homes are under a pretty significant restriction in their ability to leave without having to be quarantined at the nursing home. So I think in those sort of instances, that's where I see this technology continuing, you know, at least for the next few months, but maybe even beyond that.
And then, Farina, you can comment a little bit about the financial part, but the last thing we'll kind of end on is the big kind of elephant in the room is with deep learning, as San referenced, and telemedicine and screening. One of the big things that's been discussed is this huge need for medical providers and ophthalmologists and retina specialists, given the growing medical burden and the growing population, growing elderly population. And one of the solutions may be telemedicine and algorithms. It probably is a huge part of the solution. But do you think at some point will it decrease the need for providers? Will you need a provider for screening if you have an algorithm that can look at these photographs, it's accepted, and it's just interpretive? It's not talked about the personal touch. I think patients may prefer the personal touch. But from a legislative and kind of national health perspective, maybe that isn't an option if, again, the need providers decline sharply, even while we're kind of increasing the number of medical school spots. Do you think that's a potential issue in the future?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, I think that we're looking at a time period that is going to be, you know, very different. Obviously, you know, this has been talked about, but I think that as care is resumed in sort of a kind of newly outfitted fashion, we're going to have these patients being seen in general internal medicine, new diagnosis of diabetes and all of that. And I think that probably these screening models will make so much more sense from a, you know, from a utilitarian standpoint, but also just patient comfort, like the willingness and desire for people to be like out and about in society is pretty low. So like, would it be better to just pop into a Walgreens and, you know, get a photo and go home, and which is where you probably prefer to be right now, and then kind of see what happens from there. Interestingly, you know, I've been working on a telemedicine screening program. This is pre-COVID and unrelated, but sort of thinking about how this could be modeled in terms of from a population standpoint. And so at Genentech, Jeff Willis and Will Hopkins have worked on a teleretinal screening program in the Employee Health Center, which took off really well. Of course, we're talking about folks that are very healthy, very plugged in and all of that and pretty savvy. But I think that the employer-based model could be a really good one because, you know, when things sort of die down or when people are going back into work, and maybe that's the only place that they're going to besides the grocery store and wherever else, is that not a nice option to kind of get your screening done there? So I think, you know, it allows for sort of more kind of creative approaches that I think will change the landscape long term, because if payers find that this alters, you know, outcomes or it alters kind of reimbursement or whatever, they're going to go that path of sort of least resistance. The other thing that I think is interesting to the question that you were that you posed to Sarah, which is how might our practices change? One thing that's interesting to me, I feel like over time the retina private practice model has morphed into these, like, you know, huge expansive offices, large waiting rooms, dilation room, this room, that room. And I think that if those visits, you know, are decreased by a significant proportion, like those spaces are no longer needed. And then the overhead change, not needed entirely, but the overhead changes a lot. And then are we looking at like physician co-working digital health spaces where they're reviewing images and things like that? I think those sorts of things are kind of interesting, but who knows if they will be necessary.
Awesome. Great, great points. And we're going to wrap up in a minute, but I do want to get Ihsan's perspective and then Sarah to kind of finish as we finish this conversation.
Yeah, I've been over the years, 4 or 5 years now, doing a lot of work in machine learning, deep learning type of algorithms. And we know they're very good for, in terms of accuracy, for diagnosing things, for image recognition and patterns. And I think there was a really good study from the Google team looking at it in a real world setting in Thailand, which I think we all saw that. That was a good article that Farhina had shared. And the idea here, the reality is it's a very muddy transition when we try to take something from, you know, this incubator in terms of how we train these algorithms and apply it to the real world, because good algorithms are trained off of high quality images. You know, there's a saying that we use, it's called like garbage in, garbage out. If you train with poor image quality, you're gonna get poor results. So these algorithms are trained on very optimal type of images, good quality. But the reality is, in the real world setting, when you're doing these busy screening clinics, tons of patients coming in, different types of nurses or technicians getting pictures. And in that study, about 1 in 5 of them weren't of adequate quality, even though the patients didn't really have any pathology. But from the standpoint of these algorithms, they're sending these patients in. And that can actually overburden the clinic. That can actually drive in a lot more unnecessary volume. So there's a lot of tweaks that need to be worked out. I think a lot of us in the field have been very excited for its potential. We realize there's, in the long run, there's definitely going to be this component or an overlay of machine learning on top of what we all do clinically, but it definitely needs the human oversight. And I think that the human oversight will be that bridge for the time being as these type of programs slowly kind of, you know, creep out into the real world. Society as a whole isn't really ready to trust the robot or the machine just yet. But a lot of these studies have also shown that there's synergy, like human plus deep learning is greater than either component individually. So there's definitely going to be a transition. There's going to be a lot of human oversight. And at some point in the future, that could be years away, maybe it's ready for, you know, fully autonomous diagnostic capabilities, but not right now.
Sarah, last thoughts before we break?
So I agree with everything. I think at this point, we've seen successes with telemedicine even before COVID with retinopathy of prematurity and diabetic retinopathy screening in rural areas. We know that this is a viable approach to treating and screening patients. And so now it's sort of a question of whether or not in these sort of non-extreme cases, whether or not we can start to work telemedicine in to facilitate patient flow, to increase patient comfort and accessibility of care. You raised some concerns about patient compliance and follow-up. I think that's going to be true even with patients I have come into the clinic. Sometimes I can't get them to follow up or agree to treatment. So I think we'll find that this is going to be a good option for some of our patients going forward. And the ability to have AI sort of layer in on top of that will only help to facilitate some of the access of patients to the appropriate physician and help with screening. So I think this is going to be an area that's just going to continue to expand. But I think even though this has jump-started it, it's still going to be a slow process.
Great points. Guys, thank you so much for your time. Sorry I had to play bad cop. I had to be the bad guy because you guys are all good guys. Farina Ali, Asan Rahimi, Sarah Reed, thanks for your time. And we'll be, I'm sure, talking about this more in the future.
Thanks a lot,
Thanks
Dave.
So much.
Thanks
so much, Dave.
All right, take care, guys.
Bye. Take care, guys.
Bye. As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. You can find all 236 episodes, including this one, sorted by category, and you can subscribe to our email listserv that will allow you to subscribe for the most recent episodes. We are on Facebook and Twitter, and feel free to reach out at Retina Podcast for any ideas on future episodes or things you want to hear discussed. Remember, you can subscribe also on the podcast app on your mobile device. Many thanks to Dr. Ali, Dr. Reed, and Dr. Rahimi for joining me for this podcast. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai, Dr. Mike Benacasa, and Dr. Angela Chang for preparing this episode and the associated social media. Thank you, listeners, for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you deliver, and the articles you read and publish. They inspire conversations here every week. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.